Casual.
Casual.
Yeah. We'll discuss more on that topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. And we are discussing something very important related to upbringing. Well, Professor Naqavi, we are talking about conversations that have to be managed, that have to be controlled. You said the more we try to be casual, the more we feel actually we are being casual. We never know it's having an impact on our children. It's playing a role in their upbringing and it's shaping them one or the other way.
Exactly. So we need to be able to express our feelings and our thoughts in a very lucid manner, in a very clear manner, avoid using words and terms which are not appropriate. And certainly children, especially small children, they can't cope up with abstract issues. They cannot cope up with generalizations. They need vivid examples. So you should be good at storytelling.
Okay.
Open truths, talk about personalities, relate to them. Your own experiences or the experiences of your parents or the good experiences of your of members of society who can become role models for their children. So we need to talk about, we need to express our ideas in forms which are concrete. I mean, when you listen to someone on the on the pulpit and he is talking about very dry issues, nobody's listening. But the moment he starts expressing or talking about the story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam in the Quran, it becomes a very lively event.
Okay.
So why are our children attracted towards
animation
and whatever? So if we want to, either we're not good at it, then we need to show them animations and pictures and films which are talking about such things. But unfortunately, the number of such films is lesser than the films that are of another nature. So we need to be good at expressing our own experiences or the experiences of the positive experiences of others, relate to our children, talk about history, talk about culture, give them an expansive view of what's happening in life today, innovations, the world today, what's happening today, innovations upon innovations. I mean, talk about the future. How do we want this future to be like? How do we, I mean, you should be talking about values and ideals, but in forms which are, the children can understand. They have to be, like you see what the Quran does, it talks about the holy prophets, it talks about very beautiful...
The history,
gives role models, relates the story, and within the story, the moral is also given.
Exactly, indeed.
So this
in
is
fact,
how
in
we...
every surah, there's kind of a disease is mentioned and the cure is also mentioned.
So if we want, for example, at bedtime, if our children are used to bedtime stories, before they go off to sleep, they listen to a good story about the Holy Prophet or the Imams or the Prophets and then goes to sleep, that would give him a very beautiful
relief
and he would be dreaming about these things.
Exactly. Because psychology also proves that whatever the way, whatever you have been thinking throughout the day, or whatever you have been doing before sleep, that's something you usually see at night. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Well, Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi. One of the beautiful things that your conversation is reminding me of is the beautiful poems that Lady Fatima Zahra Salamaliha used to recite for Imam Hassan Alisa. So whenever she used to first of all call Imam Ali Alisa, she would call him with beautiful names. She would often call him with Ya Abul Hassan. And the most respected and the most beautiful names, which also show respect plus closeness. But today, we are trying to use the names, the very short, or for example, if there's some big name, we try to cut it short, or we try to actually dissect it one or the other way, trying to show our casualness, and that casualness somewhere gets disrespect. But we have to learn from Lady Fatima, who is giving respect as well as expressing her closeness. Especially in her poems with her children, she's teaching Imam Hassan alayhi salam that, "Oh Hassan, we like your father," in her poems. So that's so beautiful. She's taking care of a child, and at the same time, she's taking care of her husband, and she's expressing love for him.
Yes, that's very good. So, I mean, as I said, we should be able to communicate, and we should learn to communicate. So the learning is coming together with the managing of the children. Again, it's not just speaking out properly, it's also being a good listener. You should be able to listen to what your child is saying. From the very beginning, from early childhood, even when he goes to school, for example, he goes out with his friends, he should be taught to relate to you what he has experienced.
Indeed.
At school. So that has two positive aspects. One aspect is that he is capable, you know what's happening in the day, what's he doing, what's he up to. And he relates to you, he confides in you, you become his friend, and then you mildly point out anything which may need to be rectified or corrected in a very subtle manner. And again, the important thing is that a child would learn how to evaluate what he's been doing in the daytime. So because one of the things which have been stressed upon and emphasized as Muslims for us is that before we go to sleep, we should be able to evaluate what we've been doing in the daytime and to, you know, make a resolve that we won't be repeating those mistakes which we have done in the day, for example, or we have set for ourselves targets to achieve in the day. So we need to be able to carry out the accountability before going to sleep. So if a child is taught to relate to the parent before going off to sleep, what's been happening all the day. So in the future, when he becomes a grown-up, he knows how to, you know, carry out that that muhasabatun nafs, which is very important. And we have traditions which emphasize the fact that anyone who does not carry out that accountability every day is not amongst us.
Yeah.
So to be a true follower of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, we need to set for ourselves targets and objectives, and we need to be able to evaluate them.
Exactly. Professor, you said a very beautiful quote in our previous episodes while this accountability also came. And I want you to repeat that for our listeners.
The PDCA?
Yeah.
So we need to plan. We need to carry the things out. Plan, do, check, and adjust. And I relate this with the terminology which was used by our sages previously in Arabic. They used to say, musharata, you should condition yourself. You should make conditions with yourself that today or tomorrow I'm going to carry out this.
Yeah.
I need to, this is my tomorrow's or my weekly objectives are such. So that's conditioning ourselves and planning and conditioning ourselves for carrying out a day or a week or a month or a year. And then muraqabah, we have to be very attentive to the fact when we are carrying that thing out.
Yeah.
That is very important. Whatever we do with attention, with sincerity, with the sincerity of purpose and action. Muraqaba is from Raqib. Raqib is someone is watching upon us. We should be always aware of the fact that Allah Almighty is watching upon us.
Is all aware, all watching.
Then checking is muhasaba, accountability. And then adjusting, mu'ataba, repenting and making amends to things which we have done wrong.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming and sharing such beautiful things with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Economic divide.
The Islamic Revolution turns 44, and the Islamic Republic is standing tall, despite the maximum pressure or extreme pressure campaign by the West. How did it get there, and what strides has it made economically? Well, in this edition of the program, we will look at some of the major achievements of the Islamic Republic, which will also include some sound bites of people's grievances during the Shah's regime, which you may have not heard. All right, some of the highlights coming up in this program. The oil economy under the Pahlavi regime, the resources of oil was plundered. Then comes the democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh, the oil aspirations that he had. We will take a look at that very closely. And also the different ways that Iran's economy has moved away from oil. Another highlight, Iran's achievements. It has become a regional power. No questions about that. Also, the expansion of the middle class is one of the fruits of the Islamic Revolution, along with the nationalization of key industries. And then something that was required, that needed to be done, and it was called the resistance economy. Promoting economic self-reliance, also defeating U.S. trade sanctions, one of the purposes behind that, and another reason to discourage extravagant consumption. Iran is a vast country in the West Asia region, which sits on huge oil and gas resources. Iran's oil industry began in 1901 after Qajar kings gave a concession to British speculator William Darcy to explore and to develop southern Iran's oil resources. Masjid Suleiman, located in Khuzestan province in the southwest of the Islamic Republic of Iran, was the country's first oil well. It was drilled in 1908. It is also the first oil well in West Asia. The discovery led to the formation in 1909 of the London-based Anglo-Persian Oil Company. In fact, the British government gained direct control of the Iranian oil industry. UK's hegemony over Iran's oil industry and its revenue triggered a backlash among nationalist Iranian politicians, including Mohammad Mossadegh, who later became Iran's prime minister. Mossadegh and his ally Ayatollah Kashani led a movement to nationalize Iran's oil, but the split between the two and Mossadegh's misplaced trust in the U.S. led to his downfall. In 1953, the UK and the U.S. staged a coup against Mossadegh and toppled his governments. Iran's oil industry and its revenues were once again under the control of Western countries, especially the U.S. and the United Kingdom. The Shah's regime used the oil revenue to buy Western weapons and industrial products, which mainly benefited Western producers. During this period, Iran's oil industry remained disconnected from other industries, particularly manufacturing. This separation promoted inefficiencies in the country's overall industrial economy. It's time now to take a look at some of the social media posts. First off, Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, visited the exhibition of industrial capabilities at Imam Khomeini's Husseinia. It went on to say, based on the entry, the exhibition featured machinery, equipment, and products manufactured by various plants and factories in Iran. Iran's ministries of industries, energy, oil, and communications were all represented at the exhibition. Obviously, this shows the advancement of Iran. Next up, get to know the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Here are some of the missions of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, or the IRGC, in brief. The various ways that the IRGC not only secures Iran's security, but also its activities in different fields when it comes to Iran's economy and the Islamic Republic as a whole. Next, the Islamic Revolution has taken the responsibility of saying no to the culture of the Western world so that the real future of nations can be determined through ignoring the Western culture. The hashtag here, important, powerful Iran. Then Iran's economy after the Islamic Revolution, the GDP 1978 through 2021, 75%. And of course, we're looking at the economic growth in 43 years after the Islamic Revolution. Noteworthy, obviously, for this person to make this entry. All right, there you have it. Wish we had more time to actually peruse through some of these with you. But let's bring in our guest for this segment of the Q&A. We have Ali Rezvanpour, who's an international affairs expert, joining us. Ali Rezvanpour, welcome to Economic Divide. All right, from the time of the discovery of oil in Iran, you have foreign powers who obviously have lots of interest or had lots of interest in it, especially when it comes to when it came to exploiting Iran as a whole and to basically force it into concessions in order for them to contract the oil or extract the oil, that is, and then for them to reap the benefits. Now, the nationalization of the oil industry was supposed to be a response to these foreign interventions led by Mohammad Mossadegh, the then prime minister of Iran, but he was forced out through a U.S.-UK coup, which we all know. What benefits would a nationalization have brought Iranians at that time if it had been nationalized?
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, from the time of exploitation of colonial powers which were present in Iran during the past 100 years, and especially from the time oil was discovered in Iran, the British government, the colonial powers, on top of them the United States and Great Britain, tried to exploit Iranian oil. In these ways, we saw that different kinds of nationalistic movements in Iran, which tried to just nationalize Iranian oil industry, but it was thwarted by the policies and especially by colonial policies of the British government, and they didn't allow Iran to just take control of its oil industry and send them into the international market.
Okay, Ahmed Saleh is our next guest. He joins us now. He's a political and economic analyst. Ahmed Saleh, welcome to Economic Divide. Why do you think when it comes to the deposed Shah of Iran, he was blasted so much for devoting his, at the time, his tenure to modernizing Iran? He was really blasted for that. Of course, the money to come from massive oil revenues. Basically, he was bulldozing his way into this mass industrialization program. But he was trying to push that through really quickly, which was said to be one of his downfalls. Of course, at the same time, it was plagued, from what we understand, by mismanagement and fraud, so much so that economists at the time actually privately acknowledged that, most of the money was actually wasted. Is that what happened?
Let me give you an important example to elaborate more in details of this mismanagement and misuse of the oil revenues. In 1971, when the Nixon shock took place and the price of the oil increased dramatically four times approximately in the world, and also due to the oil embargo of the Arab countries, the quantity of the export of oil in Iran also increased drastically. The statistics, there are different statistics, but the minimum increase in the oil revenue of Iran per capita was 10 times. So the income of Iran increased by 10 times. But how this money was used? A big portion or most of this money was used to just import the final products, consuming products from America and from European countries. So this money was recycled and went back again to the source. And we know that increased the loaning capacity of the banks in the United States. And this is called the cycle of the petrodollar, which saved the American dollar from drowning when it lost, after the Nixon shock, it lost 40% of its value against, for example, the German marks in less than a year.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at a subject called common currency. Who does it pertain to? Which countries? Well, Argentina and Brazil. They actually have begun talks on forming a common currency. Now, the currency would be limited to trade and would not replace the two countries' currencies. At this point, there are also reports that these talks are on hold. But according to the latest that we have, is that they are still in the process of trying to somewhat come up with a structure for that. But it's definitely in the works. Next up, a look at Russia, Iran, and the trade between the two countries. Turnover is expected to grow under a new trade or free trade agreement between Tehran and the Eurasian Economic Union. Now, trade has surged by 15% last year, reaching $4.6 billion. Also on a side note, the news has come out that the SWIFT-like banking system has now been established between Russia and Iran. Not established, it's actually now operational, and it has started its operation in the past 48 hours as of the recording of this program. So that's somewhat related news there. Now, Nigeria is the next topic we're taking a look at in terms of the cashless environment there. It has launched a domestic card scheme to boost the cashless economy in that country. Now, this move is part of the central bank's efforts to reduce cash flow within the borders of the country, which is Africa's biggest economy. Next up, we're going to take a look at a topic that we haven't covered in a while. And this pertains to Arab countries and the currencies in those countries as a whole. Now, it appears that there's government mismanagement and external pressures that has been a result of the currency crash in some Arab countries. Now, why is that happening? Well, these Arab countries outside of the Persian Gulf have actually seen their currency devalue, and as a result, inflation has risen. Now, one particular country that is suffering from this is Iraq. Iraq, however, is blaming the U.S. for its currency devaluation, and that leads some to believe that the U.S. is using the dollar as a weapon, something that the U.S. has been accused of time and time again in the past.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Before and after the revolution. This is the title for our in-depth section. After all, what better way to gauge how the Islamic revolution is doing by taking a look at these angles? But don't forget, this is looking through the economic lens. Obviously, there are other factors at play when it comes to the performance of the Islamic revolution as a whole. Okay, first up, let's take a look at these industries, in particular, cement, aluminum, copper, and electricity. When you take a look at them, we want to see how they fared before, obviously, and after the Islamic revolution. Now, let me draw your attention to the ranking in the world and the percentage increase when it comes to them, as you see over here. That's what we want to take a look at. These are unbelievable figures. The ranking, 25, 7, not the ranking, but the amount of volume of that it has increased by 25, 17, 35-fold that you see there. It's at the bottom of your screen there, 25-fold for cement, 17-fold increase for aluminum, and then you have 35-fold increase for copper, electricity, obviously also to have increased in its production. Not only does Iran provide its people with the lowest price electricity in the world, its ranking is 16th in the world. So you can see how much Iran has improved ever since the Islamic Revolution. And if that doesn't convince you of how Iran has jumped leaps and bounds after the Islamic Revolution, well, here is another industry that may just blow your mind, the steel industry. Take a look at that in terms of the production and also in terms of the ranking. This just came out recently. Now, aside from the 19-fold increase and it being 10th in the world, again, hold on to your horses. As of November of 2022, Iran's steel industry's ranking actually increased to 7th place in the world with a production of 2.9 million tons. Now, to put things into perspective, this is while EU faced a 10.1% decrease in its steel production due to the energy crisis. Okay. Now, as far as the Iranian economy goes, we took a look at the IMF. It issued a report predicting the gross domestic product, or GDP, of 192 countries of the world, including, obviously, the Islamic Republic of Iran. The body expects Iran's GDP to reach $1,599 billion in the current year, based on the Purchasing Power Index, or PPI, the rate of which will increase by $150 billion as compared to last year. Now, according to the IMF statistics, Iran is the 21st largest economic power in the world in 2022, in spite of the tough economic sanctions that have been imposed or placed against the country. And finally, the Western maximum pressure campaign, especially by the U.S., well, has been one of the most severe in history, well, maybe now second to Russia, but here are a few examples of the damage that it has done to Iran's economy. As you can see over here with oil production, 1.5 million barrels coming off the market, to revenue denied to corporations that have exited the country, obviously in these sectors. And these are just a few that show the way that the Western powers, particularly the U.S., have tried to put extreme pressure on Iran, which has failed in terms of the maximum pressure campaign. Let me bring back our guests and get an idea from them. Ali Rezvanpour is an international affairs expert who rejoins us. Ali Rezvanpour, welcome back to Economic Divide. Now, taking a look at Iran in terms of it being a regional power, I mean, we're looking at four decades, basically, of the way that Iran has been able to do that. Different spheres, social, economic, diplomatic, and military investments. And also, we are looking at Iran's civilian nuclear energy program to have expanded. Just in the steel sector, we have now come in at seventh in the world. How did Iran reach these achievements now and not during the time of the Shah, the deposed Shah and its regime?
We have witnessed the advancement of Iranian, infrastructures, different kinds of infrastructures during the past couple of decades, especially about economic and also industrial issues. Iran has relied on its own ability, on its own knowledge-based companies, on its own knowledge-based institutes in order to improve its infrastructure. You have already seen that regarding energy, Iranian scientists have been completely successful in enriching uranium for civilian purpose or for civilian usage, and also they have used different kinds of knowledge, different kinds of advancement regarding nuclear technology in order to use in different kinds of infrastructures. So why Iran achieved these advancements and achieved these, improvements? Because it's, even though, the international community, especially the United Nations and also the U.S. government impose different kinds of harsh sanctions against Iran, Iran, by relying on its own ability, try to just prevent the harmful effects of sanctions on its own economy and improve its infrastructure and use them for the benefit of its own people.
Okay, let's bring back Ahmad Saleh, political and economic analyst, to see what he thinks. Ahmad Saleh, I want to come at you with the issue of human resources, because when it comes to the advancement of any economy in Iran, obviously, is not an exception. One of the things that does stand out is human resources, but that has to happen through educational advancements in a country, which Iran has by leaps and bounds been able to excel in. Now, the big question is, how did it manage to do that in this sector? Because some are under the false impression that the Islamic establishment, when there's a government under that, that educational learning is not something that's going to equal a Western one. So tell us more about that, if you can.
One of the main purpose of all the structures in a society, economic structures, social structures, political, military, anything, security, is the improvement in human resources. And United Nations has a very important index to compare the situation of countries in this regard. And this is the HDI, Human Development Index, which is very important, and it's mainly consisted of, very different parameters, but mainly categorized into three different factors: the income of the population, the health, and the education. And if you compare those 120 countries, which are the high HDI countries, Iran's rank is among the top three countries. So this is like a miracle. I mean, the development of the human resources. And by this human resources, we are talking about men, women, and different types of people.
All right. He mentioned the word miracle. It's a good time to take a look at the area of human resources through Iran's seventh development plan. Here is where it would be a good time to look at the role of women, how far they have come, thanks to the opportunities created for them. Well, the numbers speak for themselves, as you're about to see. This table outlines how far women have come in the Islamic Republic. Now, note the female literacy rate in rural areas, which expanded from 17% all the way to 73%. No matter how you look at it, women have come a long way since the Islamic Revolution. Following the 1978 revolution, the National Iranian Oil Company took control of Iran's petroleum industry. Iran also tried to rid itself from Western companies to develop an independent gas and oil industry. Iranian officials also defined as intergenerational capital. Western powers have imposed sanctions on Iran in order to prevent the country's ability to extract and to sell oil in international markets. The sanctions have created problems for Iran, but Iranian officials have devised various plans to stave off the sanctions and to develop mega projects in the country's oil and gas sectors. The Islamic Republic is now a regional power thanks to four decades of social, economic, diplomatic, and military advancements. The government used oil revenues to build highways, railways, factories, power plants, airports, and other infrastructure. Iran has also invested in peaceful nuclear technology in order to meet its rising energy needs. Iran is now a major producer in the steel sector. It is among the top 10 steel-producing countries in recent years.
When it comes to the Islamic Republic and its vision for the future, these are plans that have already been drawn up. That is what we'll be covering in this segment, along with some of its accomplishments. First, the 20-year national vision, which was presented in the year 2005. Iranian society at the dawn of the national vision, the year 2024, will have these features. Development in proportion to its cultural, geographical, and historic requirements, founded on Islamic and revolutionary values, in possession of, like in science and technology, and reliant on a greater share of human resources, and advancement in a secure, independent, and powerful defense system based on multilateral deterrence. Perhaps at the core of the Islamic Republic's economy lies a doctrine which is called a resistance economy. Iran's resistance economy policies, outlined by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, were meant to insulate Iran from the severe effects of Western sanctions. From 2013 onward, Iran embarked on this program geared towards significantly reducing its budgetary reliance on oil. That is because the budget bills focused on things like infrastructure reforms, health, and job creation. The seventh development plan was presented by Iran's leader in 2022 with a focus on economic progress. Comprising 26 provisions, the plan includes seven main chapters about economic issues, infrastructural affairs, cultural and scientific issues, to name a few. According to the general policies, the seventh development plan's main goal and priority is economic progress coupled with justice, with an average rate of 8% during the five-year period, with an emphasis on increasing productivity, including human resources. That does it for this segment of the program. Thanks for joining us. Please send us your thoughts. We would love to hear from you.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has withstood the test of time. Now it is entering a new phase, a shift to the east. With countries like Russia and China, which Iran has strategic agreements with, and with its membership in trade blocs like the SCO and soon-to-be BRICS, the era of Western-dominated influence will come to an end and Iran can prosper in the way that it truly deserves, because the maximum pressure campaign has failed. That does it for this edition of the program. Hope you enjoyed it. For me, Kaveh Taghwayi, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله. الله يا الله والحمد لله. الله ولا إله إلا الله. الله يا الله والله أكبر.
Today our people do not understand pseudo-intellectual speeches. One should express the people's pains in their own language. Only in such a condition will people support you, get rid themselves of abject subjection to superpowers and their affiliates, and find shelter in a strong bastion of there is no God but Allah. Exactly in this case, will all Islamic nations shake hands of brotherhood and move towards honorable life, elevation and progression in their religion and world, thus taking pleasure that is 100 times as much as this anxious and unstable life.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. This is Ali, and we are going to talk about Imam Khomeini's viewpoints with regard to the government and the relationship between the leaders and the heads of the governments and the people. In a statement, Imam Rahmatullah Ali says that this nation, that is, Iranian people, have made a revolution for the sake of Islam, in order to revive Islam. And they did this revolution and they rise in order to revive Islamic values and Islamic rulings. So this revolution has no precedent in the history of Islam at all. And for such a meaningful revolution, they have done everything. I mean, so these people are divine people, they're Muslims, and they have risen up for the sake of Allah sincerely. So they made this revolution specifically for the sake of God, for the sake of truth. So we have to serve these people in the best way possible. These statements of Imam Rahmatullah Alayh want to tell the statesmen and the head of the governments that the people that you are treating and behaving are not ordinary people. I mean, they did something which is quite exceptional in the history of Islam. At least we have no case, no other evidence or no other case like this government to happen in the course of history of Islam. So when they started, when they have risen up for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in order to spread the message of Allah, to create and to form an Islamic government, the goal of which is to establish justice, can be found nowhere else. So these people deserve to be treated well in the best way possible. And Imam actually calls them divine people. It's very important that these people are looked as divine entities. They are Muslims, but they are divine people. Why are they called divine in the words of Imam Rahmatullah Ali? It's due to their insincere intention for having this revolution, because they have done it sincerely and exactly for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So they deserve to be behaved in the best way possible, and the statesmen should know themselves as the servant of these people.
Ya Rabbana salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi
صلى الله عليه يا رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
We said earlier, we have seen lots of politicians or the statesmen that when they are looking for the votes and elections in their campaigns, they talk a lot about the people. But this person was not in need of the votes of the people for an election. He was the leader of that the leader of that nation. And he is actually looking at the government, at the heads of the government, and the people equally, and he tells them and he recommends them to treat and behave the people in the way that they deserve it. Inshallah, our statesmen know and understand the importance of these important and beautiful statements of Imam Rahmatullah Ali.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord.
Muhammad, praise be upon I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum everyone. Well, this is IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your favorite station, Youth Station.
Choo-choo-ka-choo is the Youth Station for you. I'm sorry.
That was the voice of Choo-choo-ka-choo. The inventor of Choo-choo-ka-choo is talking to you. Brother Muzaffar is here. We are going to have a wonderful session, I guess.
Yep, inshallah, we are. Sister Asma is all stressed because she's got exams and stuff. So her mind is all in her exams.
Thank you for understanding me.
She's worried about that and she's thinking, no, am I going to pass? Am I going to fail? God help me. I'll do this, I'll do that if you help me pass. Are you one of those people?
Yes.
You are one of those people, right? Okay.
Yes, I will do, of course.
It's really interesting how people have different relationships with God. Some people build that kind of a relationship where they're like, God, just help me do this and I will definitely do this for you.
Yeah.
God is so much
in need of what I'm going to do.
Exactly.
In your life, what do you think of a leader?
A leader?
Do you think we have to have a leader in every single thing we do?
Every single thing we do, yeah. I mean, it's not that we need to have a leader. It's that by default, you're going to have a leader. It's either going to be your desire is going to be your leader, or God is going to be your leader, or Shaitan is going to be your leader, or your boss at work is going to be your leader. Yeah, you're going to. I think at this point in the conversation, I am going to say yes. You always have to have a leader. Even this discussion we're having right now. So there's got to be a producer for every radio show. There's got to be every...
So you think we all are in need of a leader?
Yeah. people, you guys who are listening while driving your cars wouldn't drive unless you were leading that car, i.e. driving it.
What if I say my brain is my leader, so I need no other leaders?
Yeah, that would be your brain.
That would make sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Islamically, not so much your brain, but your intellect should be and must be your leader. You have to obey your intellect in Islam. Aql, the intellect, really important for that to actually be leading your life.
Yeah, so but we see many people who think of some rules or whatever things that are settled there as rules. They, with their brain and intellect, they do not think that that rule is just fit for them to be done or accomplished. You know what I mean? I mean, there are some rules that we have to act according to them. But then I go through them with my intellect, and then I see, so why do I have to do that? I see it the other way. So brain is not going to be enough.
Allah says to do wudu, right? But I think that wudu doesn't make sense, and I should just use soap and wash my face and then wash my hands and I'm done.
Yeah.
I feel spiritually clean now, and therefore my wudu is done. Yay. And the logic, per se, of God doesn't make sense to me. Therefore, I reject it. Is this wrong? Is this a wrong way of thinking? Yes, it is. Why is it a wrong way of thinking? Because Allah is the one who gives the laws, and we are the ones who are supposed to follow it. End of story, full stop. Allah is the leader.
Yeah.
If he commands something, you have to do it. Full stop. End of story. How do you reach Allah? That's where the thing comes into.
Yeah, the maturity say, that he is giving me this.
Yeah, anybody could say I'm following Allah.
Yeah,
like, he's my leader.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's these really secular guys. They think it's cool to have a tattoo that says "Only God can judge me."
Yeah.
Oh, big guy. So there are these silly ideologies that just occur. So you have to obey Allah wa atiyya Rasul. What? It says obey Allah and obey the messenger. Wa ulil amri minkum, and those in authority among you. Okay, so you have to figure out who these people are, the middlemen, so to speak, between you and God.
Yeah.
Because they are your real leaders.
Yeah, now, so right now, I guess, it's the best time for us to go for a short break for a change of mood. And then we'll be back. I would have a question then. So we were talking about having a leader in our life.
Do you know what I think it is, sister? I think that in today's world, there are so many controversies in the air, and there are so many different schools of thoughts and ways of thinking, and everybody's become so rigid in their own way of thinking that everybody's a little bit on edge, myself included.
Yeah.
We feel a little bit, like, can I say this? Should I not say this? If I say this, will the other person get offended? I think that there is so much tension in the air. Alhamdulillah, between us and this studio, it's not so much there.
Yeah, it's just a clear
but
air.
But it still exists, I think. I think it's that. And when it comes to leadership...
No, it's about logic, you know? I don't want to say something that doesn't sound like sound. And logical. I don't want to say something that is not so mature. And then at the same time, I would love to talk at the voice of those people who have the other side.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Be my guest. I think leadership is a bit of a controversial subject anyway.
Yeah, right? It is.
And that's why...
And many people think, even we had it throughout history, many people think that they do not need to have a leader.
You know, I used to hang around with this group in the UK when we used to go protests and stuff.
Yeah.
Most of them were communists. Now, the communists, they believe that there should be a government. They just don't like the current UK government, the capitalistic society, etc. But then there was another group who I absolutely loved. These guys, they were called the anarchists. They believe that no government should exist, and you know they should. They used to just turn up with these black flags with the anarchist A on it, and it was really cool because they just come and burn things, and just they just break things and throw stuff at the police.
Yeah,
like I'm not talking about sticks.
The word anarchy says it all.
They threw bricks, like big bricks. Anyway, I actually got into conversations with these guys, and I'm like, "You actually believe that we don't need any government?" And they were like, yeah, we don't need any government. People are fine, perfectly fine, just to live. They don't need anybody leading them.
Mm-hmm. So what happens if we don't have a leader?
Everything falls apart. It's silly to even think of that. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he actually clarified this really eloquently. Mm-hmm. He said that, look, you need a leader. You need a government. It's either going to be a bad government or a good government.
But you have to have it.
You have to have it. It's
a must.
It's a dream world, a fantasy that, oh, we could just live and we don't need anybody to lead us. No, it doesn't work like that. It simply does not.
Because things have to go in order.
Yeah.
And somebody has to do that.
Societies need... Look, even if you establish some sort of anarchist society, right, where there is no king, there's no prince, there's no president, there's no prime minister, there's no nothing. Mm-hmm. Everybody's just farmers and butchers and bakers and they're just living in harmony. Eventually, there's going to be some sort of problem. There's going to be some sort of fight. Mm-hmm. Okay, now when that fight takes place or that disagreement or somebody steals something, you're going to have to go to somebody to judge between
exactly.
you. Ta-da, you've just created
so
a
we need
judgment
an authority.
System, right? You need some sort of authority.
Mm-hmm. So that was about cities and countries and whatever.
Yes.
So now, what about myself?
Let's go back to the inner realm of Sister Asma and Brother Muzaffar, right? So inside us, we have the same thing going on, this struggle, this constant fight.
Who is the leader in there?
That's the question.
Yeah.
Now, if we are true Muslims, if we are mu'mineen, if we're believers, the leader inside ourselves is supposed to be the intellect.
Intellect, yeah.
That is the number one thing. Mm. There's others.
Pure heart also could be the leader, because the pure heart of a Muslim is the house of Allah.
Ooh, yes, yes. But when we're talking about the faculties of the inner realm, because if you go to the teachers of akhlaq, like the greats like Imam Khomeini, the teacher of Imam Khomeini, mm-hmm. Awa Shahabadi, and Ayatollah Bahjat, all these types of people, they say that there's four faculties, right? One is the intellect, one is the shahwa, the desire, one is the ghadab, the anger, rage, and one is the waham, the imagination. The imagination is often mistakenly thought of as the intellect, because in modern terms, we just think of everything as the brain.
Yeah.
It's all the brain, right? The brain is doing everything. Imagination and intellect are both in the brain. And therefore, we think that they're the same thing. They are not the same thing. They are two entirely separate entities.
Mm-hmm.
The imagination...
And how do you differentiate between them?
Yeah, so the imagination is like the eyes of the heart. That's helping you to try to get an understanding of that which you have not seen. The intellect deals with that which you've seen, you know, for certain fact.
Yeah, it has proofs.
It's proof.
Yeah.
Right? And that's another reason, by the way, why Islam, particularly Shia Islam, says you're not allowed to believe in anything until you intellectually prove it to yourself.
Yeah.
There's too many people in today's world who claim to be Muslim. They believe in Allah while they haven't proved him intellectually for themselves. They believe in the Prophet. They haven't proven it intellectually.
But I think the other way, I guess you have to first see it with your imagination and then your intellect would go according to your imagination and then it would find the proof for it.
There are certain things that you've never seen and therefore your imagination is there, your waham is there just to fill those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you can imagine all sorts of things. You and I both believe in angels. Mm-hmm. You believe in angels, right,
yeah,
sister?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, now I want you to visualize an angel.
Yeah.
I'm visualizing an angel. Now, the angel that I have in my mind and the angel that you have in your mind
are way
completely
too different.
Yeah. Right?
Yes.
It's the polytheist. It's the trait of the polytheist. of the kuffar, they think of the angels as being female forms, whereas the angels don't have male or female forms.
Yeah, they don't have. A sort of archetype that remains in your mind from your...
It's Western influence.
Childhood.
I'll tell you what
it is. It's like the fairy tales.
It's Western influence. It's Eastern influence. We've been influenced to think of the angels in that... No, that's not what they look like.
Yeah.
They still do have a humanistic form and they have wings. But the female element, we've actually... Anyway, the colors, you're probably thinking of something white. The common factor here is we've never seen angels.
Yeah, we have never seen.
We both know that they exist.
Yeah.
Right? And we know certain traits of theirs. Those we can be certain about, that they exist and that they have certain traits. Yeah. We know that for certain, absolutely.
And the proof is the Holy Book of Quran.
Yeah, okay, and that's intellect. Because your intellect has told you, through the process of, inducing this and that, we've understood without a shadow of doubt that these entities exist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the part that we don't know is the wahmi part. What do they actually look like? We've never seen it. We should agree on that which we have intellectually come to an agreement on and leave aside the wahm.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So we have four leaders inside of us.
Yes, they're like always fighting with each other.
And we should recognize which one is actually leading us.
Yeah. And I just want to quickly add here, as for anger, the faculty of anger, it actually has an opposite, which is fear.
Oh, yeah.
Fear, right? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when you are faced with some sort of danger, your intellect gets abandoned.
Exactly.
Your waham will get abandoned.
Exactly.
You don't care about those faculties anymore. What kicks in? Flight or fight response, right? Am I going to fight this danger or am I going to run away from it?
Yeah, that's very true.
Okay. That completely takes over you'll be running away and you won't even realize that you've run away. Or you'll be in the heat of a fight and you won't even know when you started to fight, right?
Yeah.
There are times where the intellect tells this faculty, you've got to take over now.
Yes.
See? And it's the same for the other faculties as well. There are some times where the intellect says, well, I've never seen this thing. I need you to go and figure
That's
it out,
true.
Imagination.
Yeah.
Or there are times where there's food in front of you and it tells you the shahwa, desire.
So you agree with this if I say that no matter how much I just reject it, how much I go against it, but after all, we need a leader inside of us outside of us, of course.
Yeah. Sorry, I kind of strayed off the subject, but you need a leader in the outside.
And we have to find it in ourselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and you mentioned it pretty much correctly that we have four leaders inside of us, and still there are more than that, I guess. It depends on the personality and you are and how you are.
When it comes to akhlaq, it just defines it as these four faculties, but those other things that you're thinking of, like the heart and things, they come under. Like the heart is actually, that part of the heart that you're thinking of is actually part of the intellect.
Exactly.
But we just don't define it in that way in modern terms.
And that's it. This was all the time that we have for today's episode. Until another session, I just say farewell to all of you. May Allah bless you with His uncountable blessings. So, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The balloon's journey across the ocean has gripped the world's attention. On Friday, the U.S. military said it mobilized fighter jets, but advised President Joe Biden against shooting the balloon out of the sky for fear debris could pose a safety threat. U.S. authorities said the military took custody of the balloon when it entered America's airspace. On Saturday, however, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon, which was being used by China in an attempt to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States, was brought down above U.S. territorial waters. Pentagon also snapped what it called China's unacceptable violation. China has expressed regret, blaming winds for pushing what it called a civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing said the balloon was used for meteorological